Sure, I turn on the recorder. So I think as most people, but not everyone knows, we're now in the third session of looking at a particular text. And the text is known, at least one translation, is the 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva. And this is the book that we're using. It's called Reflections on Silver River. The translator and commentary is Ken MacLeod, who has practiced in the Tibetan tradition for decades and speaks and reads, and of course translates from Tibetan. So you may wonder why we're doing a Tibetan text here. And I think the real reason is that this text is really beneficial, very insightful. It offers us practices, and it's refreshing because it's different than the usual kind of Zen text that we may be used to reading and looking at. The I think I'd call it the Indo-Tibetan stream of Buddhism. That's the Buddhism basic now that of Tibet, Nepal, Bhutan. Of course, originated in India. Buddhism died out in India for various reasons. But this approach to Buddhist practice survives and thrives Tibet, Nepal, Bhutan. And of course, now around the world. And I was thinking just for a few moments at the end of the last Zazen period, like, what is the characteristic of this form of Buddhism? What makes it a little bit different than, say, the Zen tradition? And in a nutshell, I would say there's two qualities that stand out for me when I read these texts. One is that the Indo-Tibetan tradition tends to be quite rational. Logical, kind of explaining things in depth, using analogies, checking understanding in this way. So that's one. And Zen is not really logical or rational in that way. And the second quality that I would say that kind of marks this is it tends to be laid out often in terms of progression, going from this point, and quite often there's pretty clear steps or steps, kind of one leading to the next, going to the next, going to the next, going to the next. And we see this very clearly in some of the Indian texts, and of course in the Indo-Tibetan texts as well, kind of seeing things laid out, almost like going up a ladder, perhaps, or a hierarchy of things. And of course Zen doesn't embrace that. It really, though, I think offers upaya, it offers us a skillful means. Not everyone wants or feels comfortable in this kind of almost shapeless form of approach to a kind of spiritual life. Not that it's really shapeless. But sometimes having it pretty clear and the steps laid out, you know, is very helpful. Sometimes you get caught in them too, and you get like, oh, well, I haven't got to step 4A yet, and I'm struggling to get to 4A. I need to do more of this or more of that. So this particular text, though, is very useful for us. It doesn't emphasize that kind of progression, I think, but it does offer us another way of looking at the practice, particularly practice in daily life. How do we want to live in this world? How do we deal with the trials and tribulations that we experience? So last thing I'll just say is Ken MacLeod. I'm not going to really talk about Ken MacLeod's commentary on these. But I do recommend reading them if you get a chance to, you know, if you either buy the book or find it in the library. His commentary is, I find, very helpful and insightful as well. So we're now in session three, as I mentioned. We're going to begin at the 11th verse. So let me read it, and then I'll just give a commentary there. these are, I should also mention this 37 verses is actually the writing of Tokme Zangpo, who lived in the 13th century and is highly esteemed in all of the traditions, the various Buddhist traditions within Tibet. He spent many years in solitary practice, and also but wrote many texts that are studied and practiced with today. Okay. Interesting, he lived just a little bit after Dogen in Japan. All suffering comes from wanting your own happiness. Complete awakening arises from the intention to help others. Therefore, exchange completely your happiness for the suffering of others. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Whoa! Maybe this first sentence makes you sit up a little bit in surprise. All suffering comes from wanting your own happiness. After all, haven't almost all of our plans, all our activities, efforts, have been to a greater or lesser extent directed at finding our own happiness? Right? Who doesn't want to be happy? In this simple sentence, Tokme Zangpo gives the briefest of summaries, I think, of the first noble truths that the Buddha taught. Life involves suffering in obvious and subtle forms, and the cause of suffering is both craving and fundamental ignorance or mistaken belief that we're separate, independent, that there's some solid me, some solid I. And these truths, these first two truths that the Buddha spoke, are expressed in many variations in all the different schools and streams that we find in the Buddhist tradition. But the very nut of all of this is that our own suffering comes from the self-centered thoughts and preoccupation with me, I, my, mine, mine. Considering ourselves separate from all others, our kind of constant self-centered thought obsesses, how can I get what I want? I'm not getting enough. I need more support. I'm suffering so much. You notice the I in there? I. And these thoughts and those kind of like it turn almost everything in our lives into the great drama starring me. Our self-centered thoughts, though, are not who we are, but they are frequently the source of distress. As the I, me, mine that reaches out to grab something is frequently thwarted, either directly or indirectly, subtly or grossly. All suffering comes from wanting your own happiness. The line In the next line in the verse, complete awakening arises from the intention to help others. Well, here, Tsongkhapa gives us the antidote. The cultivation of a heart and mind that cherishes the other, that holds the well-being of the other as dear as one's own. In the Bible, people here are familiar with the Bible to some extent. Not everybody is anymore. It's I've learned that when I was teaching at SFU. Many students had, well, they know the name, but they don't know much what goes on in there. Anyway, in the book of Matthew, which is in the New Testament, focuses on Jesus. In the book of Matthew, there's a very famous reply that Jesus gave in response to a question by a Pharisee, who also happened to be a lawyer. And the Pharisees were trying to get Jesus to kind of trip up here so they could charge him with something and throw him in jail. Anyway, it went like this. The Pharisee asked, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Which is the greatest commandment in the law, right? You know the commandments of Moses? And Jesus said unto him, I'm quoting now directly from the King James Bible, and Jesus said unto him, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is unlike to it. Thou shalt love the neighbor as thyself. Of these two commandments hang all the law and all the prophets. And I find it moving that Jesus didn't say, well, love God, but he said equal to that is to love the other, to love your neighbor, to love the other. To love one's neighbor as oneself, to exchange completely your happiness for the suffering of others, is, of course, a lifelong work. But first, I think, we need to check the truth of these statements. Now, I think a little contemplation will show that the happiness of our loved ones, right? Those we're closest to, their happiness resonates within us when they're happy, right? Doesn't kind of joy arise in our own heart when our friend, our close friend, or our child, or our lover, our spouse, our parent is just joyous for some reason, right? When you see little kids ripping apart their birthday present, wrapping to get at it, or Christmas, don't you feel some joy? Like, just how can you not feel a little happiness there? So I think that's pretty clear. Their happiness, oh yeah, I feel happy too. But giving a thought to and trying to foster the happiness of the stranger, let alone a person we're angry with, well, that's more challenging. And the only way I know is to try practice this, plunge in, and bring our attention and bring our love to those around us. I'm reading this book right now called Tales of Good and Evil, Help and Harm, by an American philosopher who just recently died named Philip Haley. And in this book, he writes of his own kind of awakening from a person who basically saw the world as force against force, and each person for themselves into something else. He grew up during the Depression in Chicago, what sounds like, you know, a really tough area. He had to fight all the time. He was Jewish. And then in World War II, he was a soldier and charging off these howitzer guns, or these huge guns in Germany, and saw many people that he had killed through this. I don't go into detail, but basically he was had gone back to college, become this professor, and these memories were killing him and making him unbearable to be around for his wife and his child. At any rate, something happened to him. And this view that he had of the world was changed by his study of a small French town called Le Cambon. Now, during World War II and the occupation of France by Germany, this small town gave safe haven to and rescued thousands of Jewish children and others that the Nazis were persecuting. And at one point, Haley, in his study, is deeply moved. He's talking to these people who, you know, at great risk, thousands of children came through this small town and were funneled into Switzerland. Anyway, at one point, Haley writes this. He says, there are those who carve out a narrow space for generosity and compassion, and those who consign all others to the indifferent, destructive forces of the world. And there are those who exclude no one from their love. Such were the people of Le Chambon, who were as intent on keeping the Germans free from soiling their lives with more murders as they were on saving the children who came to their village. So, thinking about this, how do we leave the self-centered dream that we keep falling into and instead awaken to a love that excludes no one? Tokme Zongpo writes, therefore, exchange completely your happiness for the suffering of others. This is the practice of the Bodhisattva. He's advising us to take up the practice of Tonglen, a practice that I'll talk about in a few minutes here. But I'd like to go on to the next verse, and then I'll come back to this practice. So verse 12 says, even if someone driven by desperate wants steals or makes someone else steal everything you own, dedicate to him or her your body, your wealth, and all the good you have ever done or will do. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. And when I read this, immediately what popped into my mind was a poem by the Japanese poet Ryokan. Ryokan wrote this poem when he found a thief had broken into his simple little hut and stolen everything, all his possessions. And Ryokan wrote this poem. Nusubito ni tori noko sareshi maro no tsuki. Sorry, I just love the sound of the Japanese. I need to read it. The thief left it, the moon at my window. The thief left it, the moon at my window. This poem, and I think Zongpo's verse, demonstrate an equanimity that I certainly didn't have when someone stole my wallet while I was in a coffee shop not long ago. I was pretty pissed at first. And then that was quickly followed by a bit of frantic thinking about what I needed to do next, like canceling my credit card, applying for a new driver's license, that kind of thing, right? Just going, I got this shit, I got this. I found out later that whoever took the card had bought some gas, and I think had tried to buy some booze. Was it booze, Kate, or was it a head shop?
It might have been a dispensary.
But the dispensary.
No, it was a liquor store.
It was a liquor store, yeah. And they actually didn't get the booze. They had tried, and at that point, the card, you know, kind of. That's as far as I got, anyway. And I wondered later about who he, she, they were. What state of mind and heart allows one to steal from an old bald guy having a cup of coffee? Was it desperation? A lark? Or maybe a cold heart? Did they think about the trouble and hurt that it may cause? Ryokan may have wished to give the thief the moon, but I didn't wish to give my thief my cell phone as well. I think I've got more practice to do. And yet, I did wish that they find enough remorse to stop themselves the next time an opportunity arose to steal. There is, you know, a very wonderful practice in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition of generosity, right? And what I mean by that is, aside from the usual things that come to mind when we think of generosity, like, you know, my spare change, a donation, shopping for a sick friend, in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, even if you have nothing, absolutely nothing, you can give away the beauty and goodness that you see around you. These beautiful clouds I give to you. The peaceful calm of these woods that we're walking in, I give to my troubled spouse. And perhaps you can even say, this house that we're looking at from the street, I give to your family. We are never without gifts to give away. I came across this line by the American poet Walt Whitman that really, I think, touches on the heart of this kind of giving. It's from his great long poem called Song of Myself. Just two lines here. Behold, I do not give lectures or a little charity. When I give myself. When we imagine giving everything we have away, what is left? So let's look at the next verse. Even if you have done nothing wrong at all, and someone still tries to take your head off, spurred by compassion, take all his or her venom into you. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Well, my goodness, here again, Tokme Zongpo gives us an impossible practice, right? And yet, it is a practice that is available to us always. In this life, in everyone's life, all kinds of injustices will happen. Some minor, and some that hurt very deeply. In this verse, Tsongpo offers us the practice of Tonglen that I mentioned before, sometimes translated as taking and sending. And there's other translations as well. But despite how this, from this verse, how Tonglen might seem when we first read this verse, Zangpo is not suggesting, well, just suck it up. He's offering a way to deal with the reactions of anger, despair, feelings of being unfairly cut off and unappreciated. That's what he's talking about. Tonglen reverses our usual common sense of avoiding suffering and seeking pleasure. It reverses that. In this brave practice, we visualize taking in the pain of others, or even our own pain, on the in-breath, and sending out whatever will benefit on the out-breath. And like most forms of meditation, it begins by settling your mind briefly, relaxing, having some openness and stillness, and then bringing to mind, you know, a person and a suffering that you're aware of. And you may imagine that suffering or that distress, whatever it is a kind of dark, heavy smoke. Somehow imagine breathing that in, imagining it settling in the heart area. And then from the heart area, breathing out to that person a feeling of cool, ease, comfort. Maybe as a cloud or as a white light, if that's helpful. Breathing out whatever quality is needed as an antidote to the suffering. And as I said, this is, of course, applied to others, but also to oneself. Breathing in whatever you are feeling, the fear, the sadness, the anger, and exhaling out the ease, the well-being, whatever is going to be an antidote for that particular afflictive emotion that you are wrapped up in. Now, there are lots of variations on this practice and lots of information on the internet about this. It's a powerful practice, and it is one that takes courage to do. Pema Chodron, the Tibetan teacher, has written many books, and she's written much about this practice as well. So here are just a few of her words that I think express it well. People often say that this practice goes against the grain of how we usually hold ourselves together. Truthfully, this practice does go against the grain of wanting things on our own terms, wanting everything to work out for ourselves no matter what happens to others. This practice dissolves the walls we have built around our hearts. It dissolves the layers of self-protecting we have tried so hard to create. In Buddhist language, one would say that it dissolves the fixation and clinging of ego. Use what seems as poison, use it as medicine. We can use our personal suffering as a path for compassion to all beings. So let's try this just for a few minutes together, if you would like. Just to be comfortable, but you know, maybe just take up a little meditation posture. And you can close your eyes, since we're all facing all kinds of directions, so it's a little less distraction. I'll keep it pretty simple. Just is there someone in your life that you know is struggling with some physical pain or some emotional pain, some trouble? Just bring them to mind for a moment, feeling a sense of warmth for them. And then, and again, if you like, and if this feels a little scary or something, that's fine not to do this practice. Just sit comfortably, you can listen. Imagine breathing in, into your heart. What is the trouble that they're in? Their pain, their suffering. And gently on the out-breath, breathing out, giving to them ease, relief. If you want, you can even say a word. Or imagine, as I mentioned, a kind of light or mist traveling to them and bringing them what they need. And if you like, and because it is true that whatever that person is suffering, many people are suffering in the same way. Imagine bringing in to your heart their pain as well, their suffering. And on the out-breath, relief, ease. Okay, and just for about half a minute now, maybe just let go of that practice, come back to your body, your breath, presence, sitting here, aware of the sounds. Okay. Let's stop here. Thank you for doing that. And let's carry on to the next verse. Do you mind just turning that off? Or? Even if someone broadcasts to the whole universe slanderous and ugly rumors about you, again and again with an open and caring heart, praise his or her abilities. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Well, I did say these were impossible practices earlier. In this practice, and in a few more coming up, Zangpo challenges us to respond differently from our usual response when we feel victimized, when we feel treated unfairly. In these verses, we're reminded we do not control the world, but we do have the possibility of controlling how we respond. This reminds me of a Zen story of a famous Japanese Zen teacher, a Hakuin, who lived in the 1700s. Now, I think this story may be apocryphal, but I traced it back to a book by Paul Reps and Senzaki Roshi, a book that was first written in 1957. So it has some weight to it. It's not just something you've seen. You know all these stories flying around the internet? Have you seen that website, What the Buddha Did Not Say? It's like all these, you know, misquotes of the, or things attributed to the Buddha that were never... Anyway, so I wanted to give you my source. It's a little nice story. You've probably heard it before in one version or another. So the Zen master Hakuin was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. And a beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near him. Suddenly, without warning, her parents discovered she was with child. This made her parents very angry. And she would not confess who the father was. But after much harassment by her parents, at last named Hakuin. In great anger, the parents went to Hakuin. "Is that so?" was all he said. And after the child was born, it was brought to Hakuin by the parents. And by this time, Hakuin apparently had lost most of his reputation, which did not trouble him, and he took very good care of the child. He obtained milk from his neighbors and everything else that the little one needed. A year later, the young mother finally could not stand it any longer, and she told her parents the truth. The real father of the child was the young man who worked in the fish market that her parents would not allow to marry. So the mother and father of the girl at once went to Hakuin and asked for his forgiveness and apologized at length, and to get the child back again. Hakuin was willing, and in yielding the child, all he said was, "Is that so?" So going back to the verse, can or should we praise one who slanders us? I don't know. Perhaps we can practice equanimity. We can use some phrases, you know, like, "May I accept things as they are. May I deeply accept this moment as it is. May I remain unshaken by life's rise and fall. May I remain unshaken." I don't know if I'd praise somebody who was slandering me. But I think these phrases may give some relief rather than being upset and angry, bitter. Of course you speak the truth. But may I remain unshaken. Let's do one more. Even if someone humiliates you and denounces you in front of a crowd of people, think of this person as your teacher and humbly honor him, her, them. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Well, I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I had a strong experience of this as a young man. And the person who denounced me or humiliated me, at least that's how I took it at the time, was my beloved Japanese Aikido teacher. He pointed out in detail my shortcomings and faults to a large group of fellow students. This is in Japan. And I was at that time 20 years old. He did this for reasons I did not understand at the time. And I was in tears. Much, much later, I began to appreciate the uselessness of attachment to praise and aversion to censor. Of course, I still get attached and still feel aversion when somebody criticizes me, but not like I did then. In the Tibetan and Indian traditions, the admonishment is to see a person who humiliates you as a teacher. And that's a very common teaching. It appears in many of the texts. But frankly, I feel it's a big step. Just warning you. I think perhaps we could first bring our awareness to the humiliation or shame and feel it. Just be in the body. And also acknowledge that this is a reaction. It's shared by probably everyone else on earth, a feeling of shame or humiliation. And then you may say something like this. Ah, shame. You are welcome to stay as long as you like. Now, you may find this bizarre, but I have found it really helps me to short-circuit my usual loop of blaming and shaming myself. What they said is not true, or I'm so stupid, why did I do that? I should have known better. My God, I'm almost 70 years old. When am I ever going to learn? I humiliated myself in public. I mean, you can go on and on, right? I'll never show my face there again. I can't speak to that person again. Everyone hates me. Everyone will shun me. I never found a simple way to turn off feelings of shame. But I have found saying something like that, oh, shame, helps at least to let me let go of those ridiculous tapes over and over again about how stupid I was or how unfair it is, etc. So we take refuge. We take refuge in patience. This feeling will go away at some point. We take refuge in patience and return as many times as it takes. We return to ourself. Return to the body, return to the feeling. Leaving that loop, that thought loop of shame. That's most important. And then at some point, maybe we can question the truth of what had been said or what had happened. I wonder if my Aikido teacher was directing me to parts of myself that I ignore or ignored at the age of 20. I don't remember what he said, but I realize now not then, but now, that the loss of my eagle's clothing is not the end of the world. It's not the end of the world. And maybe you can tell yourself that too. Because it is true. The world has never ended by something stupid you have done. Inadvertently or what otherwise. It's not the end of the world. You are welcome to stay as long as you like. So I think I'll stop here. We did our meditation, so instead of getting to groups, I thought this would be a good place to stop. But we have 10 minutes, and I think maybe, though I was going to ask for questions, but maybe tonight we should just do a round and we'll do our usual closing.